You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to the question, how can we prove fossil fuel companies recklessly cause deaths for big profits? Following a question by Bill McKibben, Aaron Regenberg from Public Citizen addresses the legal case.
Talking about the challenges to a prosecution, I do think that this causation question is, it's certainly what I think a lot of people have an initial gut skepticism about legally, and certainly it's what the legions of big oil lawyers are going to attack, right, every stage. So to show causation in a case like this, you need to sort of show the causal chain at three stages. You need to show that this particular death or injury was caused by this weather event, you need to, or substantially caused by, you need to show that this weather event was substantially caused by climate, and then you need to show that climate was substantially caused by these particular defendants. And so they're certainly going to go after every leg of that. We think that there are some very, very strong arguments at every leg of that, certainly in showing that climate caused these events, and then for showing that these companies caused climate. Kathy mentioned the source attribution. You know, companies are going to say that, well, you can't hold us legally accountable because we're not the only actors that have contributed to climate change. As David described, in most jurisdictions, you don't need to be the only. You need to be a substantial contributing factor. And so it's hard to know, you know, there's not currently case law for, in a criminal case, what counts as a substantial contributing factor. There are some relevant civil precedents. In, for example, Massachusetts v. EPA, the U.S. Supreme Court said that in cases alleging climate-related harms, a causal connection exists where the emissions, quote, make a meaningful contribution to greenhouse gas contributions and hence to global warming. They found that 6% in that case was meaningful. In another case, Connecticut v. American Electric Power Company, they found 2.5%. That was a different context than a criminal prosecution. It would be a higher standard, but certainly we're talking about an order of magnitude more of a contribution than that with the, you know, top 6, 7, 8 investor-owned fossil fuel companies. Last thing I'll just say that there, oil companies are also going to try to argue that on causation, that it's not them, it's consumers, right? We've already heard just a couple months ago, we all remember Darren Woods, ExxonMobil CEO, was saying it's the public's fault, it's not us. And that, I think it's useful to note, as a legal defense, that is not going to fly, right? For legally, that amounts to an argument that consumers end stage emissions constitute an intervening cause that breaks the chain of causation. And in every jurisdiction, to absolve a defendant of criminal liability, the intervening conduct needs to be unforeseeable, reasonably unforeseeable. And I think it's going to be very hard for big oil to convince a judge or jury that they did not foresee that consumers would use their products precisely as they were intended to be used, and indeed precisely as they engaged in deceit in order to get people to keep using so they wouldn't understand the risks.
You just heard from Kathy Mulvey speaking about attribution. She's with the Union of Concerned Scientists on June 4th. Aaron Regenberg is the Senior Policy Counsel at Public Citizens Climate Program. He has a follow-up on that case against fossil fuel companies. He weighs the obstacles and opportunities to finally get climate justice.
As Clinton said, I'm a Senior Policy Counsel with Public Citizen, and I'm just here to help us close out because as has been stated by all of our speakers, the disasters that have endangered Patrice and Deborah and Jenny and Rashetta and Alan, that have destroyed homes and ruined livelihoods and taken lives in communities all across the country, these disasters didn't just happen out of the blue, right? They were foreseeable and in fact foreseen consequences of decisions made by a small number of fossil fuel companies that knowingly generated a substantial portion of all global greenhouse gas emissions and fraudulently deceived the public so they could continue to generate emissions and heat up the planet. In other words, these are not just tragedies that we're hearing about today. These are harms that were forced on innocent people by sophisticated corporate actors that were aware of and consciously disregarded how their conduct would result in exactly the kinds of injuries that we've heard about today. And let's be clear, if any of us had engaged in knowing or reckless conduct that led to Alan's home getting burned down, or Jenny's business getting destroyed, or the endangerment of Patrice's health, you can bet that we would face consequences for our misbehavior, right? Whether through civil litigation or criminal prosecution or other public programs. And we're here to say that those principles legally apply to big oil companies in the exact same way. The victims and survivors of climate disasters deserve justice and accountability. And fortunately, we have mechanisms to give it to them, right? We have new legislative proposals like the climate superfund bills that have been introduced in a number of states, one of which was just signed into law in Vermont. We have the civil justice system, which is designed to repair harms and compensate those who have been injured. And that's precisely the goal of the dozens of climate accountability suits that have been filed by local and state jurisdictions all across the country, seeking damages and other forms of relief, like consumer protection measures to stop big oil from continuing to lie. And we also have the criminal justice system, which is designed to protect citizens from harm and hold wrongdoers accountable. And Public Citizen, along with a growing network of former prosecutors and other legal advocates, believe that a strong case exists that major fossil fuel companies have committed crimes like reckless endangerment for contributing to climate disasters, like criminal destruction of property for climate losses, like fraud, conspiracy, and racketeering for deceiving the public, and like reckless homicide for causing climate-related deaths. So as we head now into another summer of lethal heat waves and wildfires and hurricanes and other climate-fueled catastrophes, we think it's really important to remember every time a disaster strikes that we have solutions that can provide climate survivors with restitution and accountability from the actors responsible. It is just a matter of whether or not we're willing to stand up and fight for the justice that these victims need and deserve.
That was Aaron Regenberg from Public Citizen, recorded in a panel June 4th, 2024. And now, on to Andreas Malm. The European Save the Climate movement is more advanced. In this supposedly connected world, most people in North America never hear about it. We are about to explore a new front for environmental concern, climate adaptation measures forced by big government on behalf of megacorporations only. Take France, where an estimated 30,000 people showed up in March 2023 to protest the construction of a massive water reservoir. They were beaten and gassed by thousands of police. The reservoir, a human-made lake, is filled by pumping up groundwater. The water will go to large agribusiness fields to make up for the shortfall because of heat and drought caused by global warming. Ironically, as the world warms, water that was protected underground is now exposed in mega basin lakes to evaporation. More water is lost with every tenth of a degree of warming. The super reservoirs are also open to bacteria and other pollution. Meanwhile, the groundwater used by small farmers and nature itself, remember nature, is sucked up for corporate benefit. It is a climate solution only a capitalist militarized state could love. The location is Saint-Soline, where a reservoir is planned, an artificial lake surrounded by walls 8 feet high. French groups like the collective Bassines Non Merci et Les Soulèvements de la Terre, meaning the Earth's Uprising, and the Confédération Paysanne oppose the construction of this and about 30 more grand reservoirs planned for France in a hotter planet.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Our tour guide is the Swedish author Andreas Malm. He is Associate Professor of Human Ecology at Lund University. Andreas has also been called a Marxist. His 2021 book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Learning to Fight a World on Fire, has been adapted to a film of the same name. Asked for an interview here on Radio EcoShock, Dr. Malm declined, citing heavy commitments already to teaching and writing. He is not doing interviews currently. So we hear Andreas Malm's presentation to the 2023 conference called The Failure of Green Capitalism, Findings, Objectives, Alternatives. That was held September 15th, 2023. Malm's title for his talk is Overshoot, Climate Politics When It's Too Late. In this 12-minute audio selection, Andreas refers to the German environmental group Ende Gelände, translated as Here and No Further. This civil disobedience group has occupied coal mines in Germany, raising the issues of climate justice. They protested coal mining and fracking in Poland, the Netherlands, and the Czech Republic. Malm thinks Ende Gelände is the most inspiring environmental protest group in Europe, noting that Germany, like Sweden, is not a place where a lot of social struggle happens in this way. But he now thinks the German movement has been surpassed by the French groups fighting mega reservoirs. The French groups brought out about 30,000 people against one reservoir, which are called mega basins, and that was in March 2023. Malm estimates that is about three times bigger than the largest protest camp organized by that German group Ende Gelände. He says this is the first but not the last protest against adaptation projects in Europe. But France is the one country in Europe that has a history of protest actions in the streets. Malm says the French groups have, quote, opened a new front in climate politics in Europe, end quote. The new environmental threat may be human reaction to climate threats. Odd to think. It is important to tune into this, though. Now, with the world doing nothing to control global warming, the climate movement faces multiplying fronts needing action, Malm warns. We begin in mid-speech, talking about the state industrial complex, he says.
What is said here is that, okay, this is a fact of life. We now have climate change. There's nothing to do about it. So we have to adapt, and we have to have better systems in place for evacuating people, warning them, and not building in the wrong places, and so on and so forth. This ideology, we call it muscular adaptationism, as a kind of a subset of overshoot ideology, is now starting to circulate more and more. Wall Street Journal ran a piece the other day following in the wake of the devastating fires in Hawaii with the headline, How Better Tech Could Save Lives in a World of Bigger, Faster, More Devastating Fires. I'm going to read briefly again. A wide array of new technologies are being tested and deployed that can alert authorities minutes after a fire starts. These include tower-mounted cameras that use artificial intelligence to identify smoke and sensors that are installed just above the forest floor, sniffing out fires using a kind of electronic noise. Collectively, these fire prevention and fire detection systems have the potential to be stitched into comprehensive fire intelligence networks. Already, early versions of these networks are rapidly informing the actions of firefighters. In the future, they might generate alerts that help us all cope with wildfires. Fires are bigger, hotter, and more devastating, and the number of megafires that scorch more than 100,000 acres has increased sharply in the past decade. There is evidence that early detection of fires is one of the most cost-effective ways to tackle the problem of dangerous wildfires. Yeah, and we've seen this in closer to home as well. Here, last year after the extreme wildfires in France, Emmanuel Macron went out and said, in a lull in the firefighting, I quote, "We beat the beast that is these wildfires, and now we're going to have a major national project of reconstruction. We're going to stabilize the fire, go after the victory, and rebuild. We will have to adapt our concepts of civil security with more protective rules, a long-term prevention plan." And then Macron called for a larger fleet of firefighters. And I don't know if you remember, but 2 years ago when you had the very bad flooding here in Germany, Angela Merkel gave a speech on the site where she said, "Germany is a strong country. We will stand up to this force of nature in the short term, but also in the medium and long term." And then she called for various measures for adapting better to these kind of floods, with, of course, the preface, Germany is a strong country. And you see this kind of rhetoric returning in many places, that we can defeat this nature that is coming at us if we mobilize our technologies, and it's often merged with some kind of vaguely patriotic, nationalistic, quasi-militaristic idea that if we only get our act together and beef up enough force and muscle, we're going to be able to weather this situation. Of course, the general picture that you get here is that capitalist societies can envision combating the symptoms while allowing the drivers of global heating to speed uncontrollably ahead. And in none of these moments that I've just referred to have the immediate disasters prompted any kind of initiatives for radicalized mitigation. Instead, the reflexive reaction to these disasters is, ow, this is happening, we're going to have to adapt. And the problem here, of course, is that, okay, when the real incentives to mitigation start showing up, they're not interpreted as such, but interpreted as incentives to adaptation. So if people are not sort of realizing that we have to get rid of fossil fuels in the moment of disaster, when are they ever going to realize it? You see what I mean? Yeah. And instead, the talk becomes focused on adaptation, which, of course, it's needed, but there is a massive illusion at work here. The illusion that, okay, if we only get these intelligent firefighting networks in place, we can cope with constantly rising temperatures, or if we only get more firefighters to bomb the conflagrations in southern France, we can live with it. But, of course, there's no, I mean, in this arms race between human technology and unmitigated global warming, humans are destined to be defeated, because there's, I can't see anywhere how you can continuously build up greater technological force to keep the constantly growing disasters in check. And then the third problem with this is the problem that a lot of this will probably be maladaptation. In France, we've had a very politically interesting situation over the past year, half year, where I think we've seen the first major social struggle around an adaptation project. And I'm thinking of Les Soulèvements de la Terre and its campaign against the mega bassin. The mega bassin, the mega reservoirs, are a very strange phenomenon that I don't know of from anywhere else than in France. And what they do is that it's large agro-business companies who build giant tanks or water reservoirs into which they pump groundwater and keep it for irrigating their very large fields. And this is designed and advertised as a measure of adaptation to growing scarcity of water in the French countryside. So this is large agribusiness adapting to the difficulty of finding enough water to irrigate their fields by extracting groundwater and concentrating it, centralizing it in these giant, giant tanks. And this has, unsurprisingly, provoked a lot of anger on the French countryside, because what they mean is that small farmers are deprived of runoff and groundwater, which is instead then centralized in reservoirs where, of course, due to the increasing temperatures, this water tends to evaporate very fast. So it's a very suboptimal way of dealing with increasingly scarce water, to put it in large reservoirs where it evaporates in the heat. And we've had a movement, Les Soulèvements de la Terre, which has fought consistently with allies in the peasant movement and elsewhere in the social movement landscape in France against these megabassins. This movement is very interesting for many reasons. One is that I think now it actually outshines Ende Gelände. I mean, for a long time I've always seen Germany as the home of the most inspiring climate movement in Europe, and I've always considered this a paradox, because Germany, like Sweden, is generally not a place where a lot of social struggle happens, whereas France is the country, the one country in Europe that has a living tradition of social discontent on the streets. So I've always considered this a paradox because the climate movement has generally been stronger in Germany than in France. Now I would say that France has actually caught up and left Germany behind because Le Soulèvement de la Terre is far eclipsing Ende Gelände in terms of how many people they get into their actions and the level of mass militancy that that movement has demonstrated. Another very interesting difference is that while Ende Gelände has focused on the lignite mine, so mitigation essentially, some of the central struggles waged by Le Soulèvement de la Terre haven't been about mitigation but about adaptation, which marks the arrival of a new front in climate politics in Europe. And this is from the most famous action that Le Soulèvement de la Terre has undertaken, namely the one against the mégabassin in Sainte-Soline on the 25th of March this year, when about 30,000 people, which is, I think, more than three times as many as in the largest Ende Gelände camp, something like 30,000 people marched against the mégabassin under construction and were met with the most extreme imaginable police brutality that you can think of in Western Europe, at least. I mean, you can go to other countries in other parts of the world and you wouldn't be surprised, but even in France, which is not a foreigner or a stranger to riots and police brutality, people were absolutely shocked by the ferocity of the militarized response, with something like 5,500 grenades of various kinds fired by the police against the demonstrators and the and something like an hour and a half. And this then was followed by attempts by the Interior Ministry in France to ban and dissolve Le Soulèvement de la Terre, which is now upheld in court. And it really brought the struggle around the mégabassin to the forefront of the French political agenda. Now, I would think that this is the first, but not the last, struggle around adaptation projects in Europe and elsewhere. I think that when you see attempts to deal with the scarcity of resources, perhaps water in particular, you will see these kind of maladaptive projects where large businesses, more or less in conjunction with a militarized state, deal with approaching scarcity by trying to appropriate and control the resources in question and thereby exclude others from them, and that this leads to indignation and protest from people who are excluded from these resources. I think that in Europe it's not coincidental that we see these struggles first in what is essentially part of Southern Europe, because nowadays, in the summers, the north-south axis is pretty extremely pronounced, and Southern Europe is in a far worse state than Northern Europe. This can, of course, change, but in my country, Sweden, for instance, we haven't had a really bad summer since 2018, while the summers in Italy and France and Greece tend to get worse and worse, not to mention Spain and Portugal. And water, of course, is a key resource here, and the total failure to do anything about global warming means that we'll have more problems of water scarcity in areas such as Southern Europe, and we are likely to see more contention around projects to safeguard water resources for big companies such as the large agro-industrial companies that are dominating in the French countryside. So, one provisional hypothesis here is that in the overshoot conjuncture, the fronts for climate politics multiply. So, we are forced to wage struggles other than those that concern mitigation. Unfortunately, and this is sort of the tragedy of the overshoot conjuncture, that it imposes on us a situation where we have to deal with other as well. So not only the coal mines in Germany, but also these water reservoirs in France, and who knows what the future will hold.
That was Swedish author and professor Andreas Malm speaking September 15th, 2023 on Overshoot, Climate Politics When It's Too Late. Find a link to that YouTube video in my show blog at ecoshock.org. So there were so-called violent protests against water reservoirs in southern France reported April 4th, 2023 in Le Monde. The protest was March 24th to 26th in Sainte-Soline. Al Jazeera reports more than 25,000 people attending the protest. Le Monde characterizes it as an illegal demonstration against a massive water reserve project. Over 200 people were hurt, some seriously. One remains in a coma, the last I've heard. Police discharged more than 5,000 tear gas canisters at the crowd. Mega basin water storage has also been built in Chile and other countries. The Chilean ones tend to benefit large export farming operations like avocados, rather than local farmers. Some villages in Chile ran out of water in the drought, but were not allowed to tap into the big reserves. Corporations only. Locals say, no es sequía, es saquerol. It is not drought, it is looting. That is the slogan in Chile. Indigenous people in Mexico are also protesting giant reservoirs. Internationally, mega corporations like Coca-Cola or Nestle get access to the water. In France, the Fondation Daniel Mitterrand is making an international call, saying we are water defending itself. It includes over, quote, 300 peasant, indigenous, environmentalist, feminist, and trade union organizations from all over the world, end quote. Al Jazeera notes, opponents say that these huge artificial water reservoirs privatize a common resource for the benefit of intensive, production-driven methods of agriculture that refuse to question its method in light of climate change, end quote. More protests erupted on October 29th and 30th, 2023. Both police and protesters were injured. The protests have been prohibited. Five people were put on trial in Western France for them. They were tried in November 2023. So here we are. Rich agricultural areas with mass farming technology faces climate-driven water shortages and increased need for irrigation in the heat. Their lobby groups and the government respond with even more technology to pump out groundwater, common to all, to save up for the privileged corporations. Even if thousands of people object, thousands more police appear to gas and beat them. We enter the age of climate adaptation by force for the few. That is the new climate front, according to Andreas Malm. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Given all the mega threats around, frankly, Pilgrim, I don't like your chances. Neither does the Canadian government. Pulling no punches, their recent report is called Disruptions on the Horizon. It's pretty scary. The top 10 disruptions with the highest combined likelihood and impact are: people cannot tell what is true and what is not. Possible within 3 years. Biodiversity is lost and ecosystems collapse. Likely within 7 years. Emergency response is overwhelmed. Maybe within 6 years. Cyber attacks disable critical infrastructure. 4 years. Billionaires run the world. Within 5 years. Artificial intelligence runs wild. Possible within 6 years. Vital natural resources are scarce. Within 8 years. Downward social mobility is the norm. Within 5 years. Healthcare systems collapse. Within 6 years, maybe. Democratic systems break down. Possible within 6 years. Of course, I think some of these are already happening, and they're much more likely to happen sooner than that. We don't know for sure. The Disruptions on the Horizon report was created by Policy Horizons Canada. The authors say, quote, while the disruptions in this report are not guaranteed to take place, they are plausible, and overlooking them may carry risks in various policy areas. They add, quote, one disruption could have cascading implications in unexpected areas, and the occurrence of one disruption could set off others. Find a link to their full report in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening again this week and caring about our world.
If he knew that he was calling, the man-